From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit us at stateofbelief.com. This weekend marks the Orthodox Christian Palm Sunday. It's the new year for Theravada Buddhists, and Baha'i observance of Ramadan is halfway over.
That we're going to have to cut off Muslim students from coming to this country for some period of time.
It's more than just a fringe element.
He was never a radical.
He was brainwashed.
Where do they get their radicalization? Are there mosques, imams we should be looking at?
Horrifying criminal acts that have nothing whatsoever to do with a peace-loving religion.
For those of us who work for Interfaith Understanding, these are indeed challenging times. How best to understand the impact of these developments on our Muslim friends and neighbors? How best to stand with them? And how to respond to the inevitable challenges from some non-Muslims who are taking this opportunity to challenge the entire premise of interreligious cooperation? We're going to address some of these questions on this week's show. And we're very fortunate to have some leading voices joining us to do that. Filmmaker and civil rights activist Valerie Kaur has been working to counter faith-based prejudice since the attacks of 9/11.
Deirdre Kaur, you failed because Boston was neither bowed nor afraid. You set off a bomb, and the city gave blood for the victims. You escaped initial capture, and the city opened its doors to strangers. You were at large and making more bombs, and we gathered in prayer at Garvey Park and at the cathedral.
A profoundly thought-provoking response to the bombings has been making the rounds online. Written by Deacon Michael Rogers and originally posted on his Facebook page, the essay has subsequently appeared in America Magazine, Huffington Post, and elsewhere. The letter is a profoundly moving demonstration of empathy and forgiveness, and its author will be with us from Rome later on this week's State of Belief Radio. And I'll have a few thoughts of my own to share about what we've been seeing happen in front of our eyes since the Marathon bombing and now since the capture of the surviving suspect. But first,
this is a time when our nation and world and that city need interfaith leaders more than ever. And the first thing we have to do is to signal that these two young people represented nobody.
Eboo Patel is a popular Muslim writer and organizer who founded the Interfaith Youth Corps in 2002. Eboo, welcome to State of Belief Radio. Thanks for being with us again.
Welton, thank you so much for having me.
I think of those of us outside the Muslim American community, with the exception of those who might incorrectly be perceived as being Muslim, it's almost impossible to truly understand the fear that came along with hearing that the Boston Marathon bombing suspects identifies being Muslim. Almost 12 years after 9/11, Eboo, did you find yourself hearing that from people around you, and did you find yourself thinking that yourself?
Welton, absolutely. I mean, I am calling this being twice terrorized, the idea that you can be running in a marathon or cheering at the sideline and be a victim of a heinous act of violence. And my brother-in-law runs marathons, and we've cheered on the sides of the Chicago Marathon before, and I can imagine that unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And of course, the second part of that terrorization is the recognition that people might well be looking at Muslims, myself, my wife, my mother, my two children, through the prism of an act of terror. Mm. My 5.5-year-old got into a bit of a tussle on the playground the other day, and he said the other boy called him a name. Mm. And he still won't tell me the name the other boy called him. Now, who knows? It could be, you know, something random that Zaid has big ears, which he would have inherited, unfortunately, from his father. But maybe it was that, you know, he got called a radical Muslim or a terrorist or something along those lines. In any case, these are things that are in the back of my mind and they are all too real.
I think your Huffington Post article, Three Reasons Interfaith Efforts Matter More Than Ever, really clarifies this moment in time for those of us engaged in interreligious dialogue and activism. Let me just invite you to talk about those reasons.
You know, the way I've been thinking about this is, boy, we have to build bridges that are stronger than the bombs that other people might throw. There's a lot of reasons for why, but the three that I give in this op-ed, first one is that interfaith efforts help align people's own diverse identities. You know, everybody in America is some sort of hyphenated hybrid, and sometimes those identities feel like they're in opposition or in tension rather than in alignment or in harmony. And when you're in a conversation where people are talking about how being Irish and Catholic and American or Jewish and secular humanist and American, and those different identities are mutually enriching, you start to have that conversation within your own self. And so that's one of the reasons, mm-hmm. is to help make our diverse internal identities mutually enriching rather than mutually exclusive.
Mm-hmm.
A second reason is that we need people who are able to bring people from different backgrounds together. And not only did that happen in that beautiful service in Boston, that beautiful interfaith service, but think about all of those doctors and nurses from all different religious backgrounds, mm-hmm. operating together in hospitals in Boston. Right? That's a profound interfaith effort, and we need interfaith leaders who are able to organize everything from religiously diverse operating rooms to interfaith volunteer projects to interfaith services that take place after tragedies, whether it's Newtown or whether it's Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And the final reason is that one of the things interfaith efforts help us do is separate the worst elements of a community from the broader elements. And so if the only time you ever think or hear about Muslims is when the evening news comes on and it's reporting on some terrorist incident, then you might well look at my sons, who are 3 and almost 6, through the prism of terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
But if you know plenty about Muslims, then you are far more likely to look at terrorists who twist Islam as outliers, mm-hmm. As actually in violation of the tradition, than as somehow representative. So for those three reasons, those of us who are organizing interfaith programs, and that's just about everybody listening to this show, which is one of the reasons I love you doing this show, Welton.
Well, thank you.
I think we ought to feel emboldened to stand up, to speak out, and to build bridges.
Eboo, thank you. I found real wisdom in your describing so much of what we do every day as interfaith action.
The Catholic Church calls this the dialogue of life. It's simply the wonderful reality of living in a society in which people who orient around religion differently all contribute. And one of the things we ought to be proud of as Americans is that the United States was the first nation to believe that people coming from different parts of the earth, speaking different languages, praying to God in different ways, could come together and build a diverse democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And advancing that project is more important now than ever. And one of the reasons is because there are not a few voices and actors out there who want to destroy diverse democracies, and we have to build those bridges stronger than the power of those bombs.
Yeah.
And the second reason is that all over the world, whether it's Iraq or Kenya or Afghanistan or South Africa, societies are becoming more diverse, and they need examples of nations where diversity works well. And so whether you buy your morning coffee from an Arab Muslim, you buy your afternoon sandwich at a Jewish deli, you go to a restaurant owned by evangelical Christians, you listen to a radio station whose your favorite DJ is a secular humanist, we just ought to be aware of how people who orient around religion differently are contributing to our society and be in celebration of that and recognize that it doesn't fall from the sky. We people are advancing that, and we do it by the way we speak, by the bridges we build.
Eboo, I think that the vast majority of Americans have grown in their understanding of diversity, and that we are handling this tragic event in Boston much, much better than we handled 9/11.
I think that's right, Welton. I'm an optimist in a big way, and an optimist not just, I think, by constitution, but also because I live in America, and I'm a Muslim, and both of those identities tend towards optimism. You know, we have Muslim organizations that are far more comfortable speaking in public right now, very loudly and articulately decrying terrorism, being able to articulate how Islam speaks directly, beautifully to mercy, to peacefulness, to pluralism. That didn't exist in the same way after 2001. Many Muslim organizations back then were inwardly oriented and didn't have the same kind of eloquence, certainly the range of media contacts to be able to get on CNN, to be able to get on NPR, and to articulate a mainstream view of Islam. And I think America depends so much on people who stand up for those who are not like them. So whether that's Michael Bloomberg during the Ground Zero Mosque madness of the summer of 2010, or people like you, Welton, who've been doing this for decades and decades and decades, now we have folks saying that it is un-American, un-Christian, un-Jewish, un-humanist to paint all of our Muslim neighbors with a negative brush. And I think it's really important that there are Muslims who are saying, we got to do a better job at making sure that our religion doesn't get twisted into a form that leads to violence. While the mainstream community cannot be held responsible for the actions of terrorist groups or terrible terrorist incidents that are lone wolves, as in the case of the most recent incident in Boston, we can do better. And that's a conversation that's happening.
Ibu, how can all of us who are not Muslims be most helpful to our Muslim sisters and brothers during this time?
I think it's really important to tell stories of individual Muslims you know who are models of mercy and pluralism and dignity. Right? That matters more than any abstract concept, however important those abstract concepts, mercy and pluralism, are in Islam. Saying, you know, my doctor's a Muslim, and I've known him for 40 years, and he helped me through this really difficult time. Or my colleague at my accounting firm is a Muslim, and, you know, she's the one who's got her door open, and you can walk into her door, and she'll help you with an issue whenever possible. And it's never something that she takes credit for. It's always something that is always done for the good of her colleagues. So to tell stories of individual Muslims in our lives, I think, is really important. This is how Catholics went from being a group that experienced traumatic prejudice in America to one that is now viewed very favorably. Same with Jews, increasingly about the LGBT community, and I think it's going to be the same with Muslims.
Ibu Patel is a popular Muslim writer and activist who founded Interfaith Youth Corps in 2002. His Huffington Post article is important reading. It's titled, Three Reasons Interfaith Efforts Matter More Than Ever. We'll have that article, by the way, on stateofbelief.com. Ibu, I'm always grateful for the work that you're doing and to take time out of a really busy schedule. I appreciate you doing it.
Appreciate you, Welton. Appreciate all your listeners.
Still to come on this week's show, I'll be joined by filmmaker and civil rights activist Valerie Kaur. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back, everyone, to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. Valerie Kaur is a prominent Sikh American interfaith activist, writer, and an award-winning filmmaker. She's the founding director of Groundswell at Auburn Theological Seminary. Valerie, welcome.
Thank you so much.
In your Washington Post article titled, For Sikhs and Muslims, Fear After a Terror Attack, you make some very powerful points. The fear starts after the suspects were identified as Muslims.
Well, I would say the fear even began when the explosions went off. So I experienced the bombing as a crisis in two different ways. Like all Americans, I was grieving with Boston, a city I had called home for 3 years. I had friends and family in lockdown by the end of the week. And so, like the whole nation, I was breathing a sigh of relief when the second suspect was captured. But already we had seen racial profiling of people for the color of their skin. We've seen retaliatory hate crimes. We've seen public officials calling for counterterrorism measures that single out Muslim and immigrant communities. But I will tell you, Reverend, that when I look back on the last 2 weeks, I do believe that we are not the same nation we were in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
I do believe that our national leaders, starting with President Obama, you know, they've called for a commitment to stay true to our unity and diversity, not to rush the judgment of entire groups. And many voices have followed his lead. I remember I was so moved when Governor Deval Patrick said, "We will recover and heal if we turn to each other rather than on each other."
Yeah.
So I'm really hanging on to that hope in the coming weeks. I believe that a new generation has really come of age in the last 12 years. Millennials who have far less tolerance for overt acts of racism and bigotry, and that's true across the country. I remember when Fox News commentator Eric Rush, on the afternoon of the bombing, tweeted that Muslims are evil, let's kill them all.
Mm-hmm.
There were many more voices online and otherwise who rose to challenge him, issuing statements of solidarity and unity. And so that also gives me quite a bit of hope.
I want to be sure that our audience knows the perspective from which you speak. After 9/11, you lost a dear friend as a result of misidentification and misunderstanding. But since 9/11, you have a uniquely long-range view on this whole subject. And I'd like for you, if you will, to talk a little bit about what you did after 9/11 that gives you such credibility and authority to talk about what needs to be done now.
I was a 20-year-old college student when September 11th happened. And after Bulbir Singh Sodhi, the family friend, was murdered, I felt so helpless that I needed to do something. I mean, unlike the last 2 weeks, in the aftermath of 9/11, the hate crimes that were breaking out across the country were not being reported on national news. They were like desperate cries buried under this anthem of national unity. And so as a college student from a Sikh American background, you know, my family has lived in the United States for 100 years. My grandfather sailed by steamship from India to California in 1913. In 100 years of history, when 9/11 happened, people who looked like my grandfather, my brothers, my cousins, were automatically marked as suspicious, as foreign, as potentially terrorists. Mostly because of the turbans and beards that men in our family wear and our communities wear. And so as soon as that murder happened, I grabbed my camera, got in my car, and crossed the country to make a film called Divided We Fall, which became the first feature-length film on hate crimes after 9/11. And that led to a decade of activism and advocacy trying to combat incidents of racial profiling and hate crimes. Most recently, last August in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, a white supremacist walked into a Sikh Gurdwara and opened fire, murdering six Sikh Americans in what is now the largest race-based mass shooting in recent U.S. history. This has been part of a rising trend of hate crimes against these communities. And so we had every reason, I had every reason to brace and wait and prepare in the aftermath of the Boston bombing.
We've got to take a quick break. But I'll have a lot more time with you, Valerie Kaur, in just a minute. Later in today's show, Deacon Mike Rogers. And just a reminder that there will be more of this conversation and all of the interviews on this week's show available online at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. Welcome back, everyone, to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. My guest is filmmaker and activist Valerie Kaur. Valerie, I'd like to talk about your films for a minute and identify, if you can, some of the insights working on those projects have given you in discerning how to talk about this present situation.
I traveled to more than 200 U.S. cities, screened the film at universities and colleges. And what moved me, the insights that I gained in that experience, was the way that young people, through stories, could see themselves and other people struggle. I remember in Chicago, an African-American man standing up and pointing to his braids and saying, "My braids are my turban." Mm. I remember a gay man in New York standing up and saying, "I realize just as I fight for the right of gays to come out of the closet, I realize I have to fight for the rights of Sikhs to wear their turbans." And I remember a Japanese-American woman in Nebraska standing up and saying, "When my grandparents were in concentration camps during World War II, very few people stood up for them then. I will stand up for you now." Those gestures of solidarity made me realize that the Sikh American struggle, the Muslim American struggle, is bound up with the African American, Latino, Native, LGBT, Jewish, many other community struggles, that our struggles are part of a greater movement for equality and dignity in America. It is the old way of fighting, that we fight for our own selves, our own issues, our own causes, that more and more we're realizing that we must stand together to make progress in this country. And I will say that you know, going back to what gives me hope is that an entire multi-faith movement for justice has risen out of the ashes of 9/11 the last 12 years, that we are networked, that we have access and social media tools to hold our public officials accountable and combat hatred, that Muslim, Sikh, and other community organizations have immediately used the infrastructure they built over the last decade to condemn the bombing, to prevent hate violence. And as part of an interfaith movement, Groundswell is one network of nearly 100,000 people across different faiths and backgrounds who are coming together just this week to organize, to hold our officials accountable, to help our nation stay united. And everyday people can get involved in a way that we could not in the days after 9/11. So if folks listening want to go to groundswell-movement.org, you can join us.
What kind of organizing are you doing now in the aftermath of the bombings and the arrest? And do you see any groups utilizing Groundswell yet in this regard?
We are in conversation with our partners, with our colleagues, with advocates across the country, listening closely to what is most needed. You will see action on Groundswell's platform in the next few days. So, again, people can go to groundswell-movement.org to get involved. But I will say that I think that that action is coming, and action is coming in ways that we have not seen before. The day after the bombing, I was with students at Colby College in Maine. I was asked to talk to these students about hate crimes since 9/11. I was asked to talk to them about the mass shooting in Oak Creek last fall. When I walked into that classroom, I was expecting, you know, them to express heartbreak, indignation, perhaps anger. But they turned around and they showed me their Twitter and Facebook feeds. They showed me the ways that they were standing up against bigotry and for unity and diversity. On the same day that one of the senators from Maine, Susan Collins, was openly speculating that Islamic extremism was responsible for the attacks, before we had any evidence at all, these young people knew better. And they were asking me, "Okay, what do we do now? We're here, we're networked, we're ready. How do we take action?" Millions of young people, millions of people of all generations like them are ready to act. And I know many people in the multi-faith movement will be providing blueprints for action. Groundswell will be one of them.
Valerie Kerr is prominent Sikh American interfaith activist, writer, and an award-winning filmmaker. And she's written a most insightful piece for the Washington Post on the very real fears some of our fellow Americans are facing since the revelation that the Tsarnaev brothers identified as Muslim. For Sikhs and Muslims, fear after a terror attack. And we'll link to it from stateofbelief.com. Valerie, thanks for being with us here today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
We're going to take one more short break, and then Deacon Mike Rogers, and I'd like to share some thoughts of my own about the tragic events in Boston and what we've seen happening since then. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back, everyone, to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. Perhaps you've seen the essay that begins, "Dear Jokar, you don't know me, but you tried to kill my family." It was written by Deacon Mike Rogers, and it offers a profoundly spiritual response to what came very close to being a profoundly personal tragedy for its author. And I'm very pleased to welcome that author to State of Belief Radio. Mike, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What moved you to write and post this letter?
It was about 4 a.m. on the day after they captured Jokar, their suspect. And I was at home here in Rome, and I couldn't sleep. And I'd been thinking about, obviously, everybody at home all day. I'd been thinking of my friends and family who are on lockdown. I was getting pictures of SWAT teams walking up and down people's streets. And the neighborhood where they found him was actually where my province of Jesuits is headquartered. So I was looking at a neighborhood that I know very, very well on the news from here in Rome. And at the same time, I was thinking about this person who they were chasing through the streets of Watertown. They shut down the entire city of Boston to find him. And being a human being, just with empathy, thinking, no matter what this person did, I can't imagine how utterly afraid I would be in that moment. And so there were a lot of emotions, a lot of things turning in my head and things that I took to prayer. And at some point, I just realized, you know what? The only thing that I can do is also pray for this person. And so this letter is, in fact, in some ways, my prayer. It's my speaking to Jokar, but it's my way of saying to God, this is what I have. These are the feelings that are in my heart and the things that are in my head. And so I need to write this down. And I wrote it down just as a Facebook status. It was meant to go to my friends and family back home who had just survived this crazy day, the ones who had just survived the bombing. And that's where it all started.
I know you're just weeks away from your ordination as a Jesuit priest. Do you find this kind of empathy in scripture, in life experiences? Where do you draw from?
Well, I think I find it first in scripture. The Gospel of John is something we can take seriously or not. When Jesus says to Peter, for example, in the garden, live by the sword or die by the sword, we can choose to take that seriously or we can neglect it. I find that empathy for Christ, even in those who are coming to take him away to prison, those who are coming to begin the process of his passion and death, to be the kind of thing that I as a Christian am challenged by. I as a Jesuit am challenged by every day of my life. On September 11th, in fact, my father was in New York City, and we couldn't find him all morning because the cell phone towers were out. Over the course of the past 10 years, my response has changed. I don't think I felt as empathetic or as forgiving that day. But I think the other thing that's changed in me, I have had the chance to spend 10 years in prayer. I've had the chance to spend 10 years meeting people all around the world who have so many different life experiences. And I've realized that all we can really hope to do sometimes is love somebody the best way that we know how. And so loving this young man is, of course, holding him accountable for his actions if, in fact, he is proven guilty. And there's no questions about that. But it's also a sense of, do I love this person by praying for them? Can I keep doing that? Yes, absolutely. Can I continue to look at this person as a human being? Because that's the challenge sometimes, I think. We choose not to look at somebody as a human being. And I refuse to do that, even to somebody who, as I wrote, tried to kill my family.
I have to confess that as inspiring as your words are, it's also profoundly heartening that tens of thousands of people have found your sentiments to be worth sharing with others. That gives me hope. How does it make you feel?
Well, I'm humbled by it, deeply humbled by it. When I woke up after about 6 hours of sleep on Saturday morning and saw that it had been shared already to thousands of people beyond people that I knew, I was already humbled by it. I think that's the first thing. I think I'm grateful, particularly this moment in my life. You know, when you're coming up towards a big moment in your life, like my ordination, have something like this as an affirmation of your ministry is not a bad thing. But I think most importantly, I am grateful that I could help people begin to think about it, begin to talk more about it, begin to share it. If I could give voice to something that could help bring maybe a little more peace into the world and maybe some healing into the world, that I am profoundly grateful to have been able to be a part of that as well.
We'll link to it from our website so that all of our listeners can read the whole thing. Deacon Mike Rogers has deep connections to Boston and the marathon. He overcame fear and anger and wrote the much circulated letter to the surviving bomber, which begins with the words, "Dear Jokar, you don't know me, but you tried to kill my family. I wish you all the best for your ordination and ministry, and I'm certain we'll be reading more from you in the future. Thanks so very much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio."
Thank you very much.
Hands, touching hands, reaching out, touching me, touching you.
The recent bombings in Boston set off millions of conversations on hundreds of different related subjects. Appropriately, media are filled with reports on every phase of national security, right down to the most minute of details. Some members of Congress are using tragedy in Boston to revisit their opposition to immigration reform. In fact, one member of Congress has declared that we should no longer allow Muslims to immigrate to the United States, really. Religion is front and center as an integral part of the analysis of what happened in Boston and why. Earlier this past week, CNN reported that Yusufi Vali, executive director of the Islamic Society of Boston Cultural Center, said of the Sarna of Brothers, "I don't care who or what these criminals claim to be, but I can never recognize these criminals as part of my city or my community of faith." According to a piece from the Huffington Post, Imam Talal Eid of the Islamic Institute of Boston declared, "I would not be willing to do a funeral for him," speaking of the older brother who was shot. "This is a person who deliberately killed people. There's no room for him as a Muslim. He already left the fold of Islam by doing that." Critics of these comments think the religious leaders should continue to embrace the Sarna F. brothers, though condemn their acts. Interesting. The public never has condemned Christianity for the existence and behavior of the Ku Klux Klan. Jews have not separated themselves from Meyer Lansky and Bugsy Siegel, who claimed a devotion to Judaism. So I find the question interesting. Who has the authority to take another person's religious identity away? My guess is that the Muslims that I have quoted have mixed motives for their understandable comments meant to disassociate the actions of the two brothers from Islam. In previous times of tragedy and crisis with Muslim involvement, negative repercussions directed at Muslims have broadened and intensified the tragedy. After the horrors of the Boston bombing, how possibly could a Muslim not fear misdirected violence perpetrated by non-discriminating people who assume all Muslims are like one or two Muslims? Yes, such logic used would mean that all Christians would be vulnerable to retaliation from people who feel any one Christian represents all Christians. And great goodness, were that the case, Christians still would be experiencing punishment for the actions of the Christians in the deadly crusades of the past. But of course, the condemnation of the bombers by Yusufi Vali and Talal Eid may go well beyond a defense mechanism, an effort to make people distinguish between the evil actions of two Muslim young men and the basic teachings of Islam. The Muslim leaders well may want to claim this teachable moment and again seek to teach Americans that Islam is a peace-loving, life-respecting religion. All of us know that in all religions there are extremists who turn religion into a weapon and harm other people in the name of religion. At the same time, I don't know one world religion that is for terrorism, murder, and destruction. Not one. So maybe the conversation now underway about who is a Muslim ought to broaden its scope with an admission that in all religions there are those who will contradict religious values with acts of evil dressed up as a religious cause. Here is reality. Each of us can call ourselves whatever we want, but the ultimate judgment about our identity will be decided not by what we say about ourselves, but how we treat others. We know that good deeds come from individuals who identify themselves as non-believers or atheists, and that despicable acts of hurt are perpetrated by people who claim to be devoutly religious individuals. In the long run, what is best is to know that regardless of the label we hang around our necks or imagine posted on our foreheads is not nearly so definitive as the way we live our lives. We have too much work to do, friends, to take time to pass judgment on another person. Let's start staying busy. Busy to be the people who are shaping more secure communities by our ceaseless involvement in random but pervasive acts of doing good. Before we go, I want to tell you we lost a good friend this week, a person who's been on this show a number of times, Reverend Bob Edgar, president of Common Cause here in Washington, died suddenly this past week. I can remember his times on the show. I want you to listen to a part of a conversation that Bob and I had in Vietnam talking about taking responsibility for Agent Orange harm and the lessons for our most recent years.
Wars are not over when the last soldier leaves the battlefield. While the war had ended 35 years ago, now 30, almost 36 years ago, and I was on the House floor when we shut down the war, most Americans have put the war out of their mind. And yet children and grandchildren of the veterans who served here and the people who were sprayed are still dying, still having birth defects. I want to dedicate at least a part of my life to telling the story and helping people to recognize that in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places around the world, I hope that 25 and 30 years from now, our children and grandchildren don't have to continue to clean up the mess that we've made.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. State of Belief Radio is made possible in part by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com and consider making a contribution today. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, read transcripts, sign up for our podcast, and you can learn about the free State of Belief app for iPhone and Android devices so you can listen anytime, anywhere. Please share your thoughts on what you've heard on Facebook and Twitter. Contact information is available at stateofbelief.com, including the toll-free listener line, 800-856-0277. As always, I encourage you to tell others about the show. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member of Interfaith Alliance today at interfaithalliance.org. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me.
was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. He was.